It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The global spices and seasonings market is worth tens of billions of dollars. Research and markets data here, the worldwide market for spices is likely to reach $50 billion in coming years. And a bit of economic context there to discuss where our spices come from and why they are so important for maximizing flavors in our dishes. Join in on some unusual suspects, maybe like pepper, ginger, and cumin, or another spice that you really want to try out. Be part of this 800-642-1234. Stefano Villietti is chef and owner of Slow Food Market and three restaurants, including Trattoria Stefano in Sheboygan. Stefano, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Good morning. And we also have Ethan Frisch, who is co-founder of Burlap and Barrel. That's a spice company with global sources focusing on sustainability and equity for spice farmers. Ethan, welcome to you.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Well, Ethan, let's start with you. Trace for us the path, if you will, for how spices wend their way to the U.S. and onto our shelves in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Most people don't realize that spices are plants. They come from farms grown by farmers like any other agricultural crop. And it's a long supply chain. Farmers will harvest and then usually sell to a local buyer who sells to somebody else and sells to somebody else. And it can take years for the spices to even arrive on the supermarket shelf, let alone the years that people often hold on to them in their own kitchens. So it's a slow supply chain and an inefficient supply chain, and one that really doesn't prioritize flavor. It's about volume. It's a commodity industry. But when you taste something that's really good, that's come from a really good farmer, somebody who really cares about what they're doing, who knows a lot about what they're doing, it makes a huge difference.
Well, maybe it has changed a little bit, the spice trade, since, you know, the Silk Road and moving the spices on camel caravans, I would imagine.
You know, maybe on the surface it has, it looks like it has, but really the system of one person selling to the next person, selling to the next person has not changed much in thousands of years. I mean, what we do at Burlap and Barrel is work directly with a farmer, set them up to export their own spices, their own crops, often for the very first time. And then we import them directly. So it's a much shorter supply chain. There are other ways to run a supply chain for spices, you know, in our modern times. But the system, the general system is pretty close to what it's been for thousands of years, unfortunately.
Stefano, what have you seen in terms of trying to get your spices? How difficult is it to offer locally produced spices?
Well, really, as far as I know, other than a few things that are grown in the state, there are some grown in the state, but, you know, there's ginseng grown. I don't know if that's technically a spice or not, but there aren't a lot. I don't think our climate is necessarily suited to that. I could be wrong in that, and I will certainly love to be educated on that, but we certainly, yeah, most of our things are coming from, I guess, East Asia, like many, many things, and all of the East India companies, many, many countries, you know, Dutch, Holland had one, Portugal had one, England had one, France, they all were battling and trying to get over to the East Indies, where, and then, you know, Italy was one of the big, big players, and Italy had a lot of control early on through Venice. But I don't think I'm getting my stuff through Venice anymore, but it's, you know, it's coming through, in my case, the Spice House in Milwaukee. Mm. And for me, that was a great step up from things we used to buy from just a common purveyor. But I'm sure as we speak with Ethan through this hour, we'll find that there's even a better way and a fresher way to go. We buy a lot of whole spice. We lightly toast and grind. So we do use a local company, but I'm pretty sure these things are not coming from Wisconsin in most cases.
Ethan, what have pandemic supply chain issues done to the spice trade?
Yeah, it's been a wild ride the last couple of years. Really, the biggest impact has been on the demand side. Home cooks are using a lot more spices, cooking a lot more at home. Being a lot more adventurous, trying new recipes, getting bored with their regular rotation of meals and wanting to try new things. And spices obviously are an amazing gateway into new flavors, new recipes, new cuisines, and even a way to sort of experience different cultures from around the world when you're not able to travel. So that's been, for us, the biggest impact. We work with small producers in a lot of different countries that are really off the beaten path for global supply chains. We import wild cumin from Afghanistan. We import a super spicy black pepper from Zanzibar. These are places that were not, you know, were not major exporters before the pandemic, and so we were able to continue importing pretty steadily even when the supply chains from the bigger exporting countries were interrupted by COVID.
When you take a spice like black pepper, which is sometimes called king of spices, does it come from different places and sources? I mean, you just mentioned a more exotic type of black pepper.
Yeah, absolutely. Black pepper is a really interesting plant. It's a climbing vine, and the black peppercorns grow in little bunches. They look like grapes on the vine. They start off green, and as they ripen, they go from yellow to orange and then ultimately to red, although most black pepper is picked long before it's actually ripe because it's easier to handle. It's really just about what's easier for the middleman, not what's better for the farmer or what's better for the cook ultimately. So they pick the peppercorns underripe. And then what we see as the, you know, the sort of wrinkled black outer skin of the peppercorn is actually the dried fruit. It wrinkles up like a little raisin. And the pit, the white pit of the peppercorn, is where all of the heat is. That's where the spiciness from the black pepper comes from. And so if you have white pepper, that's just black pepper with the skin removed. Mm. There are different methods to do that. Sometimes it can be fermented, which adds a ton of flavor. Sometimes it's just sort of soaked in water for a little while until you can remove the outer skin, the outer fruit. But you get a huge range of flavor in black peppercorns, just like you do in wine grapes or coffee or any other plant. Depending on where it's grown, it's going to grow differently. It's going to taste different. And then the techniques of the farmer who grows it will also have a huge impact. So just two quick examples. We get these wild black peppercorns that I mentioned from Zanzibar, which is an island off the east coast of Africa in the Indian Ocean. Really lemony, spicy, really powerful black peppercorn, unlike anything I've ever tasted before. And then we also work with a small farm in Vietnam, a coffee and pepper farm, where they use the pepper vines to provide shade for the coffee bushes. A very different flavor profile, more herbal, more gingery, a little bit sweeter. So you get really, you know, a really wide range of flavor. Most of the black pepper, if you buy it at the supermarket and look at the back of the jar, see if there's an origin country listed. Often there's no country listed at all, or it'll be a list of several countries. Mm-hmm. Brazil is a producer. Vietnam is a huge producer. India is a huge producer. But, you know, if the origin isn't listed or there's multiple origins listed, it's not a good sign. It means that the company that you're buying from doesn't really know where it came from, or that they all got mixed together because they needed to achieve a certain volume, not really a flavor goal.
Mystery black pepper there.
Exactly.
Ethan Frisch with us, co-founder of a spice company with Global Sources. Stefano Villietti is a Wisconsin chef and restaurant owner. As we talk about flavoring dishes for the season with spice experts, you can join in with your questions on spices, 800-642-1234. Okay, here's where the fun starts. We want to pick your brain and take a peek into your kitchen. Stefano, what is the most important spice to have in your cabinet?
Well, I think, you know, I guess I would have to argue that probably black pepper is one of the most important. That's pretty common across most kitchens, probably around the world, and going back as far. And it seems like pepper was the sort of thing that launched the entire spice war, if you will. I know I was watching something this morning called, it was Space Wars versus Spice Wars, and it was kind of a joking, tongue-in-cheek thing, but you know, they talk about ships used to come back to Italy that were a special kind of ship coming back from Alexandria in Egypt, and they were the fastest ship that they made, and they were guarded by a fleet of armed ships to guard the peppercorns heading back towards Italy. So they were that sought after. So that is clearly, I mean, salt and pepper to me is the foundation of every kitchen, and frankly, often the difference between good and bad food is someone not adding salt and sometimes not adding pepper. It sounds so simple, but those basic things are so important. Beyond that, we really go into one of my favorite experiences was spending some time in Venice and cooking in a place there and bringing back about a 20 to anywhere from 18 to 23 spice blend, which we use in our cooking. In fact, the chefs sometimes have to tell me to stop it and back off a little bit because I fell so in love with it. But it's a wonderful blend of just about every sort of warm spice and a few herbs that you can possibly imagine made into this beautiful blend. So that's one of my favorites. And that, of course, includes all the things like nutmeg and mace and clove and star anise and cardamom and cinnamon and fenugreek and all these beautiful things together. And when it's all said and done, you really can't pick one of them out. in the blend, and that I kind of love. They all kind of rub a little off of each other and take the edge off of each other. And I think that's one of the beauties of blending spices, is that you kind of can hide them a little, because sometimes they can wallop you on the head and be a little too much.
So all working in concert. Ethan, how about you? What is the most important spice in your spice cabinet?
Yeah, I mean, to Stefano's point, I think often a blend is the most versatile and the most complex way to add flavor to your food, a blend of different spices. You can do something traditional, like an Herbes de Provence from France. There's a blend of different herbs, rosemary and thyme and oregano. You could do something like za'atar, a Middle Eastern spice, with a very specific variety of oregano, if you're getting the right version of it, sesame seeds and sumac. But you can also make your own blend. You know, pick the spices that you like, the flavors that you like, and mix them together, experiment, add a little bit to a dish that you already like to cook, see what impact it has on the flavor. I always like using a tomato sauce or scrambled eggs or something kind of basic to experiment with a new spice and a new flavor profile and see what it does to the dish. But there's a million possibilities around spice blends, both traditional and innovative.
Ethan Frisch there, a spice expert, former chef, Stefano Villietti, chef and restaurant owner in the Sheboygan area. Join in with your questions on using new spices, tried and true ones, how to add flavor in your dishes without going overboard in the spice cabinet, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Recent market research on spices finds Americans are being encouraged to cook more food at home to relieve stress. But COVID has had a substantial impact on the spice supply chain. Perhaps there is a spice that you haven't been able to find or has shot up in price. Join in on the world of spices, spice trade, how you incorporate them into your favorite family recipes, 800-642-1234. We have the co-founder of an East Coast-based spice company with sustainability imported spices. Ethan Frisch is here, and chef and restaurant owner out of Sheboygan, Stefano Villietti. They stay with us. Let's bring in Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So I was at a barbecue this summer with some family members and some family friends, and they were talking about black pepper, like Malabar black pepper, whatever, Zanzibar type. And they said that it lasts longer if you don't pre-grind it, like if you just have it actually where you actually have like a fresh, like cracked pepper grinder. And so my first question is, I was wondering if your guests could possibly enlighten me as to how much longer it would keep it fresh that way. And the second thing is a great tip. My kid was helping me barbecue a number of summers ago. We were trying to put some spices on some hamburgers, and he dumped a bunch of herbs on chicken. I think it was a bunch of extra Italian seasoning. It fell on the charcoal, and it actually made this really nice smoke and gave the food a really great flavor. So if you have old spices that you're trying to use up, there's a great way to do it. It works quite well on charcoal.
I love it, Marcus. Thank you for that accidental invention there. Ethan, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Old spices, a great way to get rid of old spices. Dump them over your charcoal. Marcus, to your first question, whole spices will always last a lot longer than ground spices. So as much as possible, I recommend using whole spices. You can buy inexpensive pepper grinders, little pepper mills, and pack different spices into them. Black pepper, coriander seeds, fennel seeds, even different herbs if you're getting them in larger clusters that will grind through a pepper mill. But the other thing to consider is where the spices came from and how long they sat around on the supermarket shelf or you know, in a shipping container before you got them. So buying something where you know the harvest date or buying it from a specialty purveyor will always get you a higher quality spice than what you buy at the supermarket, regardless of whether it's whole or ground. But completely agree, whole spices are the way to go as much as possible, and then grind them right before you use them.
Stefano, salt is being left out here and is feeling kind of frowny over there. So do you grind your salt as well?
We only do it. We get one in particular from an importer in the Bronx, Gustiamo. And she uses a really, really coarse Trapani from the very western coast of Sicily. And in some cases, we will grind that down, depending on the use, but a larger flake salt, like a fleur de sel, which we don't use in our restaurants because we tend to be Italian. We go with a larger flake from Sicily. But yes, that, so some are more for finishing, the larger flake. But salt is, I mean, look, there's still no salt in bread in Tuscany because they fought with Pisa, who controlled the salt trade, and their ego wouldn't let them ever put it back in their bread. So they were so angry. And when people go to Tuscany to this day, so it just shows the power of salt and pepper and spice. These things were money, and they led to exploitation and, you know, the people conquering and controlling. And it, you know, like many, many things, when they have value, suddenly it can go many directions. But I've hired so many chefs over the years, and they'll come in and cook for you, and it's a beautiful dish, and you'll take a bite and it will just be flat. And salt, kind of like acid, is one of those things that absolutely completes and pulls everything. So if I make a minestrone and I'm going to saute my carrot, celery, and onion, I'm not just going to put it in for 5 to 6. I'm going to go 30, 35, 40 minutes. And my salt, a little bit of salt, is going to now cause this beautiful pulling out of the moisture. It's kind of a osmosis, reverse osmosis kind of a thing that happens. You pull liquid out, then preparing that item to receive other flavors. So when we say we want to make a, I do these sotto olio vegetables where we salt vegetables at the end of summer. I've got vats of it put away right now. We press them for 24 hours, exuding all of their water. Mm. We then put them in vinegar for 24 hours and we press them again. And we put them in oil with herbs and spices. But by doing that salting, we've pulled out the water and prepared those, which is a lot of the vegetable, then prepared those cells to sort of receive something else. But more often than not, it is just someone not putting enough salt on a very simple preparation that leaves it falling flat. And you go to many, many restaurants, great restaurants, and you sit there and think, what's missing? And it's just that little addition which pulls everything kind of together, including the spice and the acid and the sweet. It brings it, it's like a bridge, it's a conduit, if you will, I think. It's clearly, if not the most important, one of the most important, for sure.
Ethan, any wisdom you want to add on salt?
Yes, salt is a key ingredient and often overlooked, as Stefano mentioned. I mean, the thing about salt is that there's no kind of freshness to consider. With spices, when you grind the spices, what you're doing is releasing all of the essential oils and the other aromatic compounds that are in the spice so that they go up your nose and they get into the food and you really appreciate them. Salt is a rock, essentially. And so you don't have any of those oils or other flavors to be released through a grinding process. Sometimes it's about texture, but there are also lots of different salts from around the world, and finding those slightly different mineral makeups in different salts will have a different impact on the flavor. And then the way that the salt is produced, whether it's sea salt or rock salt, will have an impact on texture. So it's still a decision about what kind of salt to use. And you know, at different points in the dish, you might want a flaky finishing salt at the end, where you might, versus a kosher salt or something more coarse in the beginning of cooking. There's still a decision to be made about the impact that you want the salt to have on your food.
Ethan, when I have it in the kitchen, I like to put one or two saffron threads in my rice water while it's cooking. And I kind of think of it as good luck because they're just so sacred and they come in that little small box. Tell us a little bit about saffron and why it's so expensive and special.
Yeah, great question. Saffron is such a special spice and really different from a lot of other spices in a lot of ways. A saffron thread is the stamen of a crocus, saffron crocus. Typically, they're grown in Iran, Afghanistan, Morocco. There's a little bit of saffron grown in Spain and Italy, but most is imported through those countries. Spain has a big sort of a kind of a counterfeit saffron industry where saffron is imported from other countries, labeled as Spanish saffron, and then re-exported.
Wow.
But each flower has to be picked by hand, and each flower yields only 3 of those little threads. So it takes, I don't remember the exact number, but hundreds of thousands of flowers to produce a pound of saffron. It's incredibly labor intensive. It has a very short harvest season, once a year. We work with saffron producers in Afghanistan, which I think produces some of the absolutely best saffron in the world. The harvest season is just a few weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks in the middle of the fall, October, November. The flowers have to be harvested in the very early morning before the hot sun dries them out. And then the saffron threads are very, very slowly dried. They're cured. Saffron has a ton of background flavor. It's not the foreground flavor that you might get from black pepper or garlic or herbs, but it has this incredible aromatic layer. People have compared it to honey or to that aroma of fresh hay. And then obviously the color that it brings
also. The color too. Let's pause there. Ethan Frisch, co-founder of a spice company in New York. Stefano Villietti is a Sheboygan-based chef and owner of several restaurants as we explore the world of spices. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we talk about spices amping up our recipes, and here's my confession, I always use more than the recipe calls for, and oftentimes way more, double down on the spices, even to the potential peril of a recipe. So vanilla and cinnamon, they are my biggest offenders. I just add more and more. I can't help it. Join in on your spice tendencies, seasonings as well, the blends, 800-642-1234. Stefano Villietti is a James Beard Award-nominated chef and restaurant owner in Sheboygan. Ethan Frisch is here, spice business owner in New York with an eye on sustainability. They stay with us. Let's bring in John in Green Bay. John, what is your question?
Yeah, there was a show on the pharmacy show on public radio a year or two ago, and their guest was a researcher, and she was finding out that the FDA was not regulating spices that much. I was kind of amazed because I was like, wow, what are we getting?
Stefano, do you know of regulations around spices as they come into our country?
I really don't. I only know that recently, this is going to sound fairly bizarre, we moved our nutmeg up to a higher shelf because we were told that people were beginning to smoke nutmeg, which I had no idea, or something with nutmeg, which sounded bizarre to me. But I also remember in college, someone that I knew tried eating vast amounts of nutmeg to try to hallucinate, which I thought was quite interesting. I think he just threw up is what happened. But no, it's, I don't know about the regulations of that. I know that my saffron that I'm holding in front of me right now is a DOP or Denominazione Origine Protetta. So mine is a Abruzzese saffron from Italy. So that one, we know exactly where that's from because its origin is protected by the Italian government. It's expensive as I won't say it, but man, it's pricey, but it is so exceptional. But no, I don't know. And I would think that Ethan probably has a little better handle on that. But you know, some things, yes, there are medicinal uses for these things, but there can also be issues if you go too far with things like turmeric and others. I think you can then have diarrhea, you can get sick. Some people might use it in its medicinal fashion to excess. And that could be a little bit of a danger, I think, sometimes. I've heard of some of those stories of people doing things maybe too much to try to cure a bad stomach or inflammation, which many of these spices do have the ability to do. But again, I don't know how much we really understand that.
Ethan, what can you field here on regulations coming into the country?
It's a great question. And I'm really glad, John, that you asked that. It's a huge sort of open area in the spice industry. I came into this, we started Burlap and Barrel about 6 years ago. I had no background in imports or any kind of interaction with the FDA. I worked in restaurants. I was an aid worker in Afghanistan and other places, but I had never imported anything before, let alone a food product. I have been, to be totally honest, I have been shocked at how little regulation there is and how little oversight there is from the government about what's being imported and what's being sold as a spice. There are all kinds of stories about sawdust and peanut shells and all kinds of other illegal additives being mixed into spices because, honestly, often it's because, I mean, companies being dishonest, of course, but also because consumers really don't know much about where their spices come from or what quality should look like, how to tell when something is good or not. And we're so unfortunately accustomed to low quality bland spices that sometimes you might not even notice if somebody has mixed sawdust into your garlic powder because you weren't expecting it to taste like very much to begin with. Yeah, it's I think a huge risk in the industry and a warning for home cooks to be thoughtful about what you're buying and where it's coming from, so that you can kind of keep yourself safe when the FDA is
ask
not
those
doing it
questions.
For you.
Yes, John, thank you for bringing that up. Let's go to Patrick in Madison. Patrick, hi.
Hi, this is Patrick. Thanks for having me and taking my call. I'm a spice blender by trade. I own a company called The Deliciouser here in Madison, and I work with Burlap and Barrel, so it's great to talk with Ethan.
That's awesome. What would you like to bring up, Patrick?
It was kind of a COVID pivot away from 30 years of cooking and owning restaurants, and we started this company called The Deliciouser so that we could bring, you know, the world of spice and travel back to people who were, you know, in lockdown due to COVID. And we during that time fell in love with the quality of their spices and the story that those spices tell. In particular, the buffalo ginger, the Icelandic sea kelp, the peppercorns from Tanzania, his Vietnamese cinnamon. These are all really high quality ingredients. And I just wanted to thank Ethan for bringing those to the market, and especially the sumac that we use in our za'atar. So I just wanted to give a shout out to Burlap and Barrel and tell them to, you know, keep up the good work.
What a lovely connection there. Patrick, thank you. Ethan, go ahead.
Nice. Thank you, Patrick. It's so great to hear your voice. Great to talk to you on the radio. And I really
of
appreciate it.
Of all things.
It. Yeah, exactly.
I liked how Patrick said that each spice tells a story. I would imagine, Ethan, you have a story for so many spices.
Yeah, every spice that we import is from a farm. We know the farmers, we know the individuals who are producing the spices. I have a new baby at home now, but before he was born, I was traveling a lot, spending time with our partner farmers around the world. We're a social enterprise, a public benefit corporation, which is a new corporate status that kind of blends for-profit and nonprofit. And our focus is on bringing new spices to market, helping farmers set themselves up to export their own spices, make more money, have more control over the supply chains that historically they have always initiated, right? Spices always came from farms, but farmers had no insight into where they were going or how they were being sold or really how much they were being sold for at their final destination. Farmers were left out of all of that. And as we know from apples or, you know, any other agricultural product, any other crop, the skill of the farmer makes a huge difference. And this had just been totally overlooked in the spice trade. We had seen it happen in coffee and tea and other industries, but not for spices before. And so I got the idea for Burlap and Barrel when I was living in Afghanistan. I lived there for about 2.5 years. I worked for a big nonprofit, an aid organization, working on a school construction project all throughout the northeast of the country. And there's an amazing variety of wild cumin that grows in the mountains. I had cooked in restaurants in New York. I thought I knew what I was talking about when it came to spices. And then I tasted this wild cumin and had a revelation. I just had never tasted anything like it before and started bringing it home, initially not as a business, just to share with friends in the restaurant industry because I was so excited about it. And then that led to the realization that there would be other spices, other producers in other countries who were growing products of a similar quality and uniqueness. And with the same kind of attention and care for sustainability and organic practices, regenerative practices, often traditional agricultural practices that had been sort of lost in larger scale operations. And so we extended that same idea out and started working with a co-op in Tanzania, the black pepper that Patrick mentioned, wild sumac from Turkey, buffalo ginger from a group of farmers in northern Vietnam, royal cinnamon, the other Vietnamese cinnamon that Patrick mentioned, our number one bestseller. Super sweet, spicy heirloom cinnamon, a different species from what you usually find in supermarkets. And you can really taste that difference. It's amazing.
Oh, thank you for that origin story there. Appreciate it. Let's bring in Eric in Phillips. Eric, hi, go ahead.
Yes, hi, good morning. Earlier in the show, and my wife also watches a lot of Food Network, you hear one word, salt, 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 salt. You hear things like salt your pasta water till it tastes like the ocean, which we never do because I'm worried about the health effects of too much salt. Sure, as humans, yep, we like salt to taste good. But at what point does it go from tasting good to giving everybody a coronary heart attack?
Stefano, what is the right balance?
Well, I guess, you know, We do salt our pasta water, certainly, but like anything, you have to have balance. It can go from being bland to being inedible the other direction pretty quickly. Same thing when we're cooking beans. If we're cooking our beans, whether we're doing them baked in the oven with spices and things like that, which we do often versus boiling, you really have to be careful. You want to kind of go a little under, but at the same time, you can't really catch up at the end necessarily. That's the other part of it. So when I'm making, for example, a pot of minestrone or a soup, I layer, I saute the initial ingredient, I season it. When I add my next ingredient, my squash or my potatoes or something like that, or my green beans, I will then season again a little bit. So I'm really watching as I go. And I think cooks have to be a little careful. That's often people will come in, they'll do a stage or cook for me or something, and they'll cook something and they'll say, well, I'm going to season it at the end. And I'm like, you know, you really, that doesn't really work. Certain things maybe, but you kind of have to coax it along. You just kind of get used to it over the years of cooking. I can look at a mound of food that if I'm making 25 or 30 gallons of soup, which we do on a regular basis, large batches, you really have to kind of go along slowly, taste as you go. That's one of the things I tell people is that as you're going along, taste. We keep tasting spoons next to us as we're cooking. We're constantly tasting. And again, just be careful. You'd rather be, I think, a little bit under versus a little bit over. But oftentimes people come to a restaurant and say, your food, it seems like it's over-seasoned. I say, well, maybe you just don't season correctly sometimes. And we don't say that, but we kind of say, okay, sure, we'll watch that. But I think sometimes people can mistake a well-seasoned food, including spices and other things like that, and say it's salty. It might just be that it's really flavorful. I don't mean that to sound insulting. But oftentimes people are struck when things actually come out tasting fantastic. And I know that can sound a little snotty, but sometimes that can be the case. Just be careful, like any spice, you know, just you got to be careful with it.
Stefano, chefs you hear talk about blooming spices and that terminology. What does, you know, blooming spices mean or you know, in terms of toasting them or heating them up?
Well, I'll give you my example. One of my favorite things to make is our chili at Field de Fork. And I love our chili. And it has some of my Venetian spice blends. So there are 20 to 24 spices. It's a big mix. And I sometimes just forget what the hell I'm grabbing. But they're all over our kitchen. We make this. I lay them out on a beautiful plate. And they're all whole spices. And they look gorgeous. And then I take them in a very sort of a very lightly warm pan. I lightly toast them. Then we grind them. And then when I'm making that chili, I put my onions, my garlic, a little bit of jalapeno, even a little fresh cilantro down, which I also add some late. But then I add my chili, a little cumin, some coriander, a little of my Venetian spice, and I let that get into the oils. Oils, lipids are great transmitters of flavor. So if you try to put all those spices and just throw them in later and dump them into when the meat's in and the beer is in and the tomato is in and all those things are in, they're going to be in there, but they're not going to be in there at a fundamental level. And when I put it in with the oil early with the onions and the garlic, then I will put those spices and turn my heat way down and let those things just kind of toast a little bit further in the oil. You don't want to burn them because you can lose some of their nuances. And that's, you got to be careful there too. But I will let them sort of give what they have to the lipid or the fat. And then I continue with the dish. Then the meat goes in. Other things going, but then I know that lipid is going to take those flavors through everything in the dish and you'll taste it all throughout. And you won't be able to pick out clove or nutmeg or mace or any of those. It'll just be, and I was actually watching a show. It was a great chili cook-off. This was years ago. It was a Texas chili cook-off. Mm-hmm. And every guy was like, I just do meat and beans and that's it. No BS. And it was just kind of like the typical thing you'd expect. And one guy said, I use about 19 or 16 or 6 different spices. And I have clove and nutmeg. And he was not your normal, like, Texas chili looking guy kind of thing. But he used all these spices. I said, well, I'm going to try that. And it absolutely blew my mind. And it just rounds it out. And you don't even know what you're necessarily tasting. You just know it is so good. And it has levels and levels. That's what I would say. It's depth of flavor. It's depth versus just being surface.
Spice revelations, Chef Stefano Villietti there, as we tour the world of spices, how they interact with our taste buds. Ethan Frisch, as well, spice expert and business owner. You can join in. Still time to talk about spices, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we explore spices and the spice trade with Stefano Villietti, who's a chef and restaurant owner for nearly 30 years, three restaurants in Wisconsin. Ethan Frisch is here, co-founder of a spice company that focuses on equity and sustainability. Let's bring on another call now. Let's go to Pat calling from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Pat. What's your question?
Hi, I'm wondering, like, when I buy whole spices, if I don't use them within a year, is there a way to store them better? Like, should I be storing them a certain way right when I buy them?
Great question, Pat. Ethan, go ahead.
Great question, Pat. It starts with what you're buying and where you're buying it from, of course, making sure that it's fresh. If you know it's a spice that you're not going to be using for a long time, you can always put it in the freezer. It will keep better in the freezer, but the risk is that taking it in and out can introduce moisture, condensation into the jar, which can reduce the flavor. But if it's something you're not going to use for a long time, go ahead and toss it into the freezer. Otherwise, store it in a place where you can see it, where you can reach for it as you're cooking. I find that that's really the most effective way to use spices. You know, unlike wine or people, they don't get better with age. So, try to use them. And if you find that you're not using something, maybe it's time to rotate it out. You can compost it or the tip that a caller mentioned earlier, toss it on your charcoal for a smoky flavor filling and replace it with something new.
Stefano, any other insights there on storing spices or when do spices go bad?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely try to move through them, and we just don't want to buy them in too large a quantity. You want to resist the urge to save money and buy large amounts, but then you have to make sure it goes through. We like to store in glass if we can also, and then just try to definitely avoid heat. We try to keep them where it's not bright, not under direct lights. And, it's one of those things, it's kind of like a lot of things, little less heat, little less light. And again, just using quickly, and that's the key. And that's why you just don't buy too much. And how many times have you brought home a jar of something that you look down, you've already got another one in your cabinet? Yeah. Like, oh shoot, I did it again. That kind of thing can happen. But I think that's another argument going back to buying whole again. And just really that to me is so important. You were talking about how people can put sawdust in things, and another good argument for really watching where you get it and buying whole whenever you can. It just gives you so much more control, and there's not that surface area exposure. When you grind something, think you've gone from having this single little, whether it's a dried bud of clove or something, or a star anise fruit, whatever it is, to having millions of little pieces of powder all exposed to air versus that closed little pod or that closed little fruit. So I think that's the key, really, is knowing that once you sort of open it up and it explodes and its beauty and that smell, it's going to lose it. So you really hate to do that. That's where fresh grind pepper and the spices, that's really, really a good thing. And I just wanted to mention too, the gentleman that called from Madison, we just brought in five of his spices for our store.
Oh,
and
awesome.
They are not on the shelf. We brought in his bomba, which is a Calabrian chili mix. I think we brought in maybe his mezzogiorno. I'm not sure, but we just bought four or five of his spices that we're selling in our slow food market in Sheboygan.
Awesome.
So I guess, Ethan, we're using some of your products, I guess.
all around here.
Right.
Joy now in West Bend. Joy, what do you have for us?
Hi. I have a couple of things, actually, I thought of while I was waiting. I have to plant my garlic this week, and I just want to encourage anyone who's listening to grow your own garlic. It's quite easy. And then the results are wonderful, of course. How can you start any dish without garlic? Mm-hmm. And then my question is, we have sumac in our yard. We just transplanted some that we saw growing wild. We wanted it for ornamental purposes, and I'm wondering, can we harvest that somehow to use as a spice?
Is wild sumac edible? Can they use it as a spice, Ethan?
Yeah, you absolutely can. Sumac is a classic Middle Eastern seasoning. It's a really tart kind of lemony flavor, usually used as a finishing spice instead of lemon juice or lime juice. You do a little sprinkle of sumac, and it's really beautiful. The berries are purple or maroon, so you get a really nice color. There are two or three species of sumac that are native to North America. Not knowing which one you might have, what you're looking for to be able to harvest are little cones of berries. The berries look like fuzzy purple lentils. They're little round flat berries and they grow in cones. You'll find them around this time of year through the late summer into the fall. Pull one off the tree and taste it. There's a hard pit in the center, so just be careful, don't bite down, but taste the fruit around the pit. If it's tart and delicious, then go for it. there is also something called poison sumac, which has the same name, obviously, but a totally different plant and doesn't produce berries and doesn't grow in the same way. So you don't have to be worried about that. The easiest thing that you can make with sumac from your backyard is pink lemonade. Pull some of those berries off, rinse them off in cold water, and then pour boiling water over them or cook them in hot water until you have a really beautiful purple color and sour flavor. Let them infuse and then add some sugar and you're good to go. That's pink lemonade.
Wow. Easy. Fun. Joy, thank you for that question. We're going to land on pumpkin spice. And I can't even say it with a straight face because it's everywhere. Stefano, what dishes include pumpkin spice in your restaurants or do you use it at all?
I don't even know what the heck pumpkin spice is, to be honest with you. I'm assuming it's a blend of spices.
It is.
We will be making pumpkin pies from squash. We do make our pies from squash itself. But that's just, to me, as far as I know, it's, cinnamon, nutmeg, maybe mace, things like that. Those are the flavors I think of. And really, this is the season right now. And if I think to summer, yes, we use spices, we use pepper, use salt, but it seems to me like when the cold winds of fall start to blow, that's when the spice cabinet gets opened up. And I just think it's so much, I actually love winter cooking almost as much or more than summer. You can't argue with the bounty of summer, right? We deal with 20 farms here, it's amazing. But when you start getting the cool weather and making venison or, cooking beef cheeks with clove and cinnamon from very far northern southeast, maybe near the Austrian border in Italy, that's the kind of, when I start to think about that, cardamom breads, things like that. But pumpkin spice, yeah, I guess I'm assuming it's a mix of warm spices, but I'm not a pumpkin spice expert. But I did want to mention too, that we were bringing in an amazing sumac scented almond, I believe from either Afghanistan or Iran. And it was a woman owned business. And it was a fantastic, I think we still have the product. I know that, I think they had some supply interruptions, but it was sumac scented almonds and it was just fantastic. And I hadn't really had sumac a lot, so it was a wonderful way to try it. It was very bright, an incredible flavor. But yeah, pumpkin spice, I'm sorry, I don't know a lot about pumpkin
That's
spice.
Okay. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you both for joining us, Stefano and Ethan.
Thank you
Thanks
so
for
much.
Having me.
Stefano Viglietti, chef and owner of several restaurants around Sheboygan. Ethan Frisch, co-founder of Burlap and Barrel, a spice company with global sources. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.